On June 3rd and 4th, 2025, the Institut National de la Recherche Scientifique hosted an Arctic Symposium, Perspectives on Gender, in Montreal. This international event brought together Inuit and non-Inuit researchers, artists, and activists to engage in meaningful dialogue on gender across the Arctic regions of Canada and Greenland. The symposium aimed to spark critical conversations, foster connections, and create space for knowledge sharing that extends beyond traditional academic boundaries. As part of this ongoing effort, we're proud to present this audio capsule. It is a collaborative project designed to carry forward the discussions that began at the symposium. By mobilizing guest speakers' presentations, we explore the theme of care and how care is lived and practiced, not as sentimentality, but as a political, decolonial, and relational commitment. My name is Christine Hillassie-Lussier. I'm from Saluit, though I'm affiliated to Kojo-Arabic. I'm a PhD student in Inuit oral history in the individualized program at Concordia University. I also work with Inuit youths in care and as a research assistant looking at Inuit youth leadership. I was happy to be a part of the Arctic Symposium Perspectives on Gender as a guest speaker and will be narrating this audio capsule. Care in research and institutions. As the Arctic Symposium took place within an academic institution, we wanted to start our reflection on how care is lived and practiced in research and in academia. For Natasha Ita McDonald from Kojo-Arabic Nunavik, the founder of Silat Tusarnik Community Solutions Consulting and a former assistant professor at McGill University, that means embracing gendered ways of knowing that are rooted in Inuit values and epistemologies.
So did I recognize how women and gender diverse people contribute to our Inuit knowledge systems? So it was an interesting journey. And so part of gendered ways of knowing, again, through NWAC, trying to find out what it means to look through a gendered lens. You know, the idea is that we look for moments of relationality. We look for moments of care. We look for moments of intergenerational knowledge transmission, and that there be a community-based accountability. And I said, okay, this is also interesting. I can look back on my research. Some of this sounds familiar. And so, you know, in terms of my studies, so I went back to Nunavik, to my home region, to conduct dialogical interviews with adults, 18 and up, and also with students. So what was IQ, just as a reminder? And IQ being a framework that was developed in Nunavut, and it's not the be-all and end-all, but it is a framework to be able to analyze educational systems through an Inuit epistemology. So through Inukhatiritsernik, Dunganaknik, inclusivity, and Biitsinik, which is providing for, and Birikhatirinik, which is decisions made by consensus, Biriksaknik, learning by doing, our traditional ways of learning, Ikayukhatirinik, collaborating, working together for the common cause, and Khanukdurnik, which is adapting. And for me, that was one of the key ones because I also look at technology and how we can use that to protect language and culture. So through the gendered lens, you know, where is relationality, care, intergenerational knowledge transmission, and community-based accountability? When you look at the framework of IQ, you can really see some of those aspects there.
For myself, care and research is also about who holds the space and how.
I'm going to create elders and artists committee from Nunavik and from the South, all Inuit, who will supervise and guide my research that I will do with Inuit youths so that we can work with the archives that are reposited down here. At Avatak Cultural Institute. So they're very inaccessible to our community members up north. So I want to bring those up north and have the youths learn our oral histories, through arts-based methods.
And for Mette, a Danish researcher working in Greenland, care demands more than consultation or recognition. It calls for an embodied humility, slowness, and the willingness to let go of control.
Today, I hope to speak across difference without erasing it, and to explore how care and knowledge might be reimagined through relationships and responsibility and accountability, rather than through extraction or translation.
By refusing to translate or extract Inuit women's stories for the purposes of academic recognition or external validation, Mette enacts a form of care that resists the extractive norms of academia.
I didn't come to know as they do, but the questions that these Kalaallit women and health workers helped me ask began to land differently. So it's an honor to have been invited to speak here today among so many whose work, art, and activism have guided my thinking. I do not come to this conversation to explain or analyze or present any findings from my research, but I am here to stay with the complexities. Which brings me to a question that shadows my work and follows me into every part of the research process and moments like this. As a white, non-Indigenous researcher from Denmark, should I even be doing research in Kalaallit Nunaat, a place still deeply shaped by Denmark's colonial legacy? I hold this question open not to paralyze myself, but to stay accountable, to remind myself that how I show up matters. And today I hope to speak across difference without erasing it, and to explore how care and knowledge might be reimagined through relationships and responsibility and accountability, rather than through extraction or translation.
Reflexivity and ethical accountability. Research rooted in care demands ongoing reflection, not just on the questions we ask, but on who we are as researchers, and what histories, assumptions, and power dynamics we carry into the spaces and relationships we engage with. It calls us to be accountable not only to our methods, but on the communities we work with, recognizing that knowledge is always shaped by context, identity, and relationship. For Natasha, that means developing a framework, Silat Dusarnik, that is grounded in reflexivity and community values.
The idea with Silat Dusarnik is that it comes from an Inuk perspective, because in Inuk doing research, you're coming with your own perspective, that you have an ethical responsibility and relationality and reflexivity, a sense of who you are in yourself in your research. And again, you know, you look at the four elements, if I can call them that, and I say, okay, again, not too bad. Wow, I was on the right track, I think. And even thinking about rigor, because, you know, how develop a new framework, what does it mean then? How do you ensure that it's rigorous? And because I don't care about replicability. I care about whether or not it is valuable and valid to my community members.
Mette echoes this. For her, reflexivity means being aware of how colonial knowledge systems even shape the questions we ask.
Kuakanen calls this epistemic ignorance the institutional choice to ignore Indigenous knowledge, even when it is offered, and it has consequences. When relational knowledge isn't recognized, it becomes dismissible. When care can't be translated into institutional categories, it risks being ignored. And when knowledge isn't formalized, it becomes precarious, even when it is lived, shared, and sustaining.
Lydia Hissi, a PhD student at INRS, works on sexuality and pleasure in Nunavik. For her, care means resisting institutional tendencies to minimize women's agency.
This requires navigating institutional structures that are often more comfortable with protecting women than with trusting them. It means pushing back against research ethics processes that often pathologize sexuality or that assume pleasure is not a valid object of study.
Care is not neutral. In the Arctic, where colonial histories and ongoing systemic harms run deep, care can also be a deliberate decolonial practice. Genuine care centers the values, priorities, and ways of knowing defined by communities themselves, not by colonial institutions or academic standards of rigor. Mette points out that colonization did not only harm indigenous bodies and lands, but it also shaped definitions of what care is and whose care counts as legitimate.
Biomedical training teaches to recognize protocols, data, measurable outcomes, but it rarely teaches to recognize the kinds of knowledge that emerge in relation, in embodied experience and silence. These epistemic hierarchies don't just shape what is known, they also shape how it is known and who is allowed to be the knower. And they reproduce themselves in clinical guidelines, institutional design, professional training, and definitions of best practice. And much of the health research that aims to include local voices risk reproducing these hierarchies. So while health research increasingly includes local perspectives, these are often treated as supplementary rather than foundational and as being in opposition.
Marie Evaldsen Christensen, a PhD student at Aarhus University, echoes this decolonial shift by focusing her research not on survival or decline, but on the everyday joys and emotional textures of Inuit life.
I, with my project, instead want to move the focus away from function and utilization towards the everyday joys, happinesses and sillinesses and the humors and frustrations, annoyances and grievances that are also part and parcel of a hunting life, so as not to reduce Inuit hunting lives to a life of survival and adaptation. Rather than framing hunting lives in Northwest Greenland as lives that are on the brink of extinction, so to speak, which has been the dominant framework in recent years, or as lives that are continuously adapting to changing climates, whether they be literally in the sense of climate change or in the unpredictable political climate we're all part of right now. My focus in my project is instead on the good, so on how joy is emerging in North Greenlandic hunting lives too, from eating delicious country food, from listening excitedly in on the hunting radio during a narwhal or a polar bear hunt, to celebrating birthdays and anniversaries with cake, food, and dance.
Care also lives in how women support each other and how communities celebrate together. In Marie's work, this sociality shines during hunts.
They give gifts, they celebrate successful catches by throwing coins in the air, and they call their friends to boast, and so forth. So it's not necessarily just if someone close to them catches a whale, but it's also just if there's this intense sociality that overcomes the community. So there's a collective excitement, a sort of community emerging.
Lydia adds that reclaiming pleasure is itself a powerful form of care and resistance, especially when that pleasure has long been erased, dismissed, or silenced in the public imagination.
Pleasure and joy can give us a sense of normalcy and grounding in everyday life. These experiences of joy and pleasure do not experience the harm or suffering, but they can exist even when it's not a conscious act. Finding joy in the midst of hardship can be a form of resistance. Yet that is exactly what I'm attempted to do in my PhD research, create space for Inuit women to speak about pleasure, desire, and sexuality on their own terms.
If care is to be transformative, it must include all of us, not just in theory, but in lived practice. This includes actively making space for queer, trans, non-binary, and two-spirit kin, especially in communities where visibility has been erased and where colonial systems continue to marginalize, punish, or pathologize gender nonconformity. Diane Obed from Nunatsiavut, a PhD student in educational foundations and a powerful advocate for inclusive futures, reminds us that care includes vigilance, a sharpened awareness of who is seen, who is heard, and who remains invisible in our spaces and institutions.
Was to help create more space and visibility for in between, for trans and non-binary peoples. Because I myself, again, having been orphaned in a way, I'm often very sensitive to whose voices are we not really seeing or hearing, who are not represented. I'm always aware of who's invisible in these conversations.
This act of noticing is not passive. It's an intentional and ongoing practice. It is care as advocacy, care as insistence.
So creating culturally relevant gender-affirming spaces, I think we as Inuit, we know what it feels like to be marginalized and othered, and we have intimate knowledge of these feelings of exclusion. And my hope is that we recognize that these feelings are especially acute for non-binary, trans, Inuit kin. That Inuit women, gender-diverse people, youth, are not an afterthought. We are the heart of our communities. Our stories, our frameworks, our ways of knowing are essential for the next generations.
Mikhail Libro from Ilulissat Nunarput, an advocate for Inuit rights, brings this point into sharper relief, grounding it in the lived realities of colonial violence and institutional erasure. For Mekali, care is a demand for justice, for access, and for survival.
That Inuit queers are being criminalized at the moment in our own lands by Danish authorities. Like when Inuit get gender-affirming care in, for example, Denmark, and when they return to our country, the Danish police would knock on the door and say, you got this medicine. So, and it's not allowed here. And then they will confiscate it. What does it mean for people like us or trans people who has gone this, gone through all of this? It hurts even more for those people. Why shouldn't they be cared for?
And yet, as Mikhaili notes, Inuit gender understandings were never fixed. They are fluid, relational, and responsive to the needs of the individual and the community.
So gender was not static at all. It was fluid, as it was needed in our communities.
These perspectives remind us that care is not universal. It must be specific, intersectional, and grounded in cultural sovereignty. To understand care, we must also return to its origins, that is, birth, kinship, and the teachings of women. In the North, midwifery is more than a medical act. It is a political, ecological, and spiritual practice rooted in ancestral wisdom. Suzy Bazile, a professor at UCAT, shares how Atikamekw midwives were once the cornerstones of birth and the keepers of embodied knowledge, before colonial systems of medicine replaced their roles within institutionalized care.
Les femmes, les sages-femmes plutôt étaient les pierres angulaires de l'accouchement et de toutes les dimensions des savoirs qui sont reliées. Les femmes deviennent les gardiennes de ce savoir-là. Donc, la majorité des femmes avaient soit elles-mêmes été sages-femmes ou encore se souvenaient ou avaient rencontré plusieurs sages-femmes étaient même membres de leur propre famille. Donc, ce savoir-là, elles l'ont toujours, elles le détiennent toujours, bien que la pratique ne soit plus en place.
Even when no longer practiced openly, these ways of knowing persist. Suzy also recounts ceremonial care, the treatment of the placenta, which reveals an intimate ecology between body and land.
Les femmes prenaient le temps de bien s'occuper du placenta, parce que quand tu regardes le placenta, ça ressemble à un arbre. C'est ce que l'on m'a enseigné. Elles, les femmes, enveloppaient le placenta avant de l'enterrer parce que c'est le placenta qui va prendre soin de la terre par la suite. Autrefois, l'hiver, le placenta était brûlé. J'ai beaucoup aimé ce que ma mère m'a raconté. Elle m'a enseigné beaucoup de choses. Le placenta va grandir et de belles choses vont pousser.
Care here is material and metaphorical, a recognition that what grows from the body also nurtures the earth, that knowledge and life are entangled. Akka Hansen, an Inuk film director and activist from Nuuk, continues this thread, speaking about parenting as a form of decolonial care. She challenges Danish paradigms of control over children and reframes care as relational guidance, especially in helping children to come to their own will.
So one of the things that I know is very important is that you are first and foremost born Inuk, like a human. Also one of the things is that you are born Inuk with a will. And that's different from Western way of raising children, because I could see that in many of my Danish friends' way of raising their children is that I know best what's best for you, because I'm older than you, then I'm higher than you, like in a hierarchy. And I remember one of the things that happened when my daughter was born is that I told my then partner that it's 8 o'clock, you have to like put her to bed. And he was like, but I don't think she wants to. And I'm like, what do you mean, like she doesn't want to? It's the night. And then I was reminded that of course she has a will. She's a baby, but of course she has a will and her own will, and she has to get to know that. And that's one of the things that is one of the responsibilities as parents, is that we have to, of course, help children navigate and make them aware of their own will and get to know themselves.
These teachings remind us that care is not coercion, it's recognition. It's about raising children not to conform, but to know, trust, and express who they are. When we think about care, we often forget to name the emotional labor that goes unseen. And we especially overlook how colonialism has shaped emotional expectations for men. But as several speakers reminded us, care is also about emotional reclamation, allowing men and boys to feel, express, and be held. Nuuk's Lindell, an Inuk artist from Akhviat Nunavut, brings us into this conversation with a reflection on what has been lost and what can be rebuilt.
Inuit had a way of talking out their feelings, because you could not go out on the land and you could not go out on the land with a troubled mind. You can't just bottle everything up and then go out on the land. That's almost like disrespecting the land, because when you're hunting, you need all your brain power, and you can't be weighed down by, you know, any emotional stress. So Inuit had a way of talking things out, which through residential school was cut off.
Silencing emotion, especially among men, was part of the violence. But reclaiming those emotional expressions is also resistance. Nuuk's offers a vision of parenting that prioritizes emotional literacy and mutual respect.
Being able to express yourself and express your feelings, that's hard. That's tough work. And it takes a lot of strength. And that doesn't make you weaker. It makes you a more, I guess, for lack of a better word, like a better, more useful person, more capable, because you're not, you're less likely to just like explode and do something harmful, which is getting to be very common with a lot of Inuit, especially Inuit men. So that being said, raising my kids, I try to tell them about that, like tell them about my struggles. I try to get as much knowledge as I can about Inuit, Inuminuk, like the way Inuit would raise kids, which is some are very gendered, but I think that's because of the church, because you it just straight up says like boys roles, girls roles. And you see a lot of that like in my town. And that's something that we don't want to follow. So it's like looking at, well, all the things Inuit used to do, but then having to filter out, you know, the Christian influence of it. And one of the main things was letting your child be themselves, and not every child is the same. And so letting your child kind of be who they are, and being a safe place for being able to do that. I want all my kids to know how to hunt, but I want them all to know how to sew too, just the basics. And then whatever they excel in, whatever, you know, you could see if a kid likes doing something.
Care here is not just support, it is also strength. Not softness as weakness, but softness as courage. Teaching boys to sew, to feel, to cry, is a radical act in a world that has long punished them for doing so. These stories call us to expand our definitions of care. To see it not only in the maternal or the medical, but in the emotional, the relational, the everyday work of undoing harm and rebuilding connection. Storytelling is more than a practice. It is an act of care, a form of transmission, a way of holding and sharing what matters. In the Arctic, stories are omnipresent and are vessels of humor, relationality, and knowledge. They teach, warn, and affirm and connect. Christine Tuttu, an artist, activist, and youth coordinator at the Kivalliq Inuit Association, reflects on how stories offer a space to affirm cultural values, especially for Inuit youth.
We each, all of us as Inuit, have a responsibility to learn as much as we can from a decolonized perspective, from a view outside of the gender binary, so that we can fill in those gaps and teach as many other generations as we can.
This vision of care is forward-looking. To tend to stories is to tend to futures. But it also requires unlearning of the ways colonial languages and norms have narrowed our imagination. Christine shares a pivotal moment of self-reflection while retelling a traditional Inuit story.
And that was just such a shift for me, because why did I think the orphan was a boy? And it led me to question myself more when I was told stories about traditional stories and told stories in gender-neutral terms. So it did a really big shift in my thinking for gender and gender-neutral language.
This small moment holds big questions. What unconscious assumptions do we bring into stories? How do those assumptions shape what becomes visible, sayable, or possible? Carissa Inuyak Metcalf-Co, a Kakinit practitioner and a parliamentary affairs advisor to the Senator of Nunavut, continues this reflection by turning our attention to aesthetic traditions, like Inuit tattooing, that carry stories in and on the body. For her, care and beauty are inseparable. They reside in how we remember and how we relate.
But if you ask majority of Inuit what makes somebody beautiful, it's not necessarily their appearance, but their role in society, their role in their family, how they take care of themselves and others, how they take care of the animals, the Nuna, the land. These are all qualities that build you into a capable person that is able to uplift those around you. And that is what makes us beautiful.
For Carissa, beauty is relational. It's not only defined by individual appearance, but by how one carries themselves in relation to community, to land, and to responsibility. Reclaiming traditional tattooing is, for her, a reclamation of this worldview. Storytelling, whether spoken, embodied, or inked into the skin, is thus a form of care that resists erasure. It holds space for multiple truths, challenges colonial logics, and reaffirms Inuit knowledge systems grounded in connection and relational accountability. Academia is also a collection of storytellers, and the majority of the stories of the Arctic are told by non-Indigenous peoples. As a form of care, Inuit matriarch and professor Carla Jensen-Williamson has worked tirelessly to use and honor Inuit ways of knowing within the academe, and to tell Indigenous stories according to Indigenous and Inuit principles.
And yet, you know, my both grandmothers on both sides used to say, you know, in order for you to be able to make a contribution to our safety and well-being in this new setting, you need to come up with some ideas that are profound, that can settle us in a good way as a family to be able to cope with the atrocities that happen to around us. And that better be based on balanced ideas of Chimikutaniku and Sakushu. They would be saying it very quickly. I'll go like, what the heck is that about, right? So as I'm saying, physical aspects, aspects of the soul that is anosak, and that of the aspects of spirit. Well, we never learned anything like that in the school system. Nothing, absolutely nothing, because we were to become, you know, binary beings of body and the soul.
For Carla, care also includes the whole, the body, the soul, and the spirit. She stresses that knowledge cannot be compartmentalized, but that to know, one has to know the whole.
So knowledge is then as holistic as it becomes, whereby we have this balanced idea of coming up with some ideas that nourish you soul-wise, spiritual-wise, but also good for your body.
There is a clear need for research in the Arctic that foregrounds care. Not care confined to Western hegemonic epistemologies and normative frameworks, but an approach that is attuned to the relational, situated, and often subtle dimensions of everyday life. This kind of care requires approaches that account for the entanglements of gender, kinship, ecology, and livelihood, and that attend to the holistic and place-specific ways in which care is enacted and experienced in Arctic communities. As we wrap up, we want to take a moment to thank all those whose time, voices, and work made this conversation possible. The Arctic Symposium on Gender was hosted at l'Institut National de la Recherche Scientifique in Montreal on June 3, 2025. Thank you to Christine Hillassy-Lussier for the narration of this audio capsule. Thank you to Kelly Vu and Félix Caron-Boudrias for the technical production and editing, and thank you to Lydia Rissi for the research and script development. We acknowledge the dedication of the organizing committee, Magali Quintal-Marino, Natasha Ita McDonald, Susie Basil, Lydia Rissi, and Marie Evaldson Christensen. We're grateful to our guest speakers whose insights and reflections have enriched this discussion on care, gender, and community in the Arctic. This series was made possible through the generous support of Réseau Dialogue and Paktutit Inuit Women of Canada. Kisiki asiki, 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 asiki